Louis Menand is a New Yorker writer and a Harvard professor. He won the Pulitzer Prize for History back in 2002 for his book The Metaphysical Club. Well, now, Menand has written a book for a series called Issues of Our Time, a book about higher education. It's called The Marketplace of Ideas, Reform and Resistance in the American University. Menand is a professor of English, and he's especially interested in higher education and the humanities. One issue he addresses is how a PhD in literature became both more common and more difficult to achieve, even as the number of jobs for PhDs in literature declined. Menand says there are several reasons for that.
One is that there was an enormous increase in the number of universities in the United States between 1945 and 1970. It was this, what people in the business of higher education call the golden age of American universities. This enormous amount of increase of undergraduates, even bigger amount of increase of graduate students, and an enormous number of new campuses opened up in the 1950s and 1960s. And this expansion expanded the number of doctoral programs so that a new institution, in order to establish more credibility for itself in the higher education system, would add doctoral programs in various subjects and start awarding PhDs. So this caused a ballooning of the number of people with PhDs who were going on the market looking for jobs as professors, college teachers. Then after 1970, the system started to slow down and even go backwards, and you ended up with an enormous number of PhDs for a declining number of slots for
them. But that decline is 40 years underway. When you say since 1970, that's a long time ago. You'd think the numbers would have ratcheted down over that time.
Yeah, it's astonishing to me that the number of PhDs awarded has been going up pretty steadily since the 1970s, and the number of job openings has more or less been going down. It seems to be a process that people have a very hard time reversing. The other piece of it, which is even more amazing to me, is that the time it takes to get the PhD has been increasing steadily since the 1970s, so that the median time to get a PhD in a humanities discipline like philosophy, English, art history is 9 years. Half of people who get PhDs in those fields take more than 9 years to get the degree. Now, if you think that you can get a law degree and argue a case before the Supreme Court in 3 years, get a medical degree and cut somebody open in 4 years, why should it take 9 years to teach poetry to college freshmen? And there are a number of factors involved in that. One, obviously, is the job market. Another is the fact of part-time hiring. That is, a lot of graduate students teach college students, and they do it quite full-time for very little money because they're still enrolled as students in their institutions. The median age for people getting a degree in the humanities, getting a PhD, is 35. Mm-hmm. So if you think about that, it's an astonishingly long apprenticeship in a profession that really shouldn't require that much training.
So it sounds like the number of PhDs being awarded in those fields is driven as much by the number of professors who teach graduate students and who assign them dissertations as it is by the possibility for ever getting a job being one of those people.
Yeah, it's true. There have been several studies, long-term studies of career outcomes of people who've gotten PhDs. And one of those studies showed that of people who got PhDs in English, and only about half the people who enroll in graduate programs in English actually get the PhD, only 5% of those ended up teaching in research universities, which is really what we're training our students to do. So there's a real disjunction between the training students receive to become research scholars and the kind of teaching that most of them will end up doing, which don't involve training graduate students and generally don't involve a huge amount of research, but they still need the PhD to get those jobs.
After your brief detour in law school, I gather you spent a year in law school. How many years was it getting your PhD in English at Columbia University, and how old were you when you emerged with it?
Yeah, I went to law school for not very good reasons. When I graduated from college, I stayed only a year, and then I went to graduate school in English at Columbia. I was 6 years getting my degree, and I was, I guess, 28 when I got my first job.
Well, 6 years would be a sprint by contemporary standards, too.
That actually, in the 60s, that was the norm. About 4.5 years in the sciences and about 6 years in the humanities. So you can see how far we've come since that time.
Well, Louis Menand, author of The Marketplace of Ideas, thank you very much for talking with us about it.
Thank you, Robert.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. The genre of memoir has been troublesome in publishing recently. The truthfulness of many bestsellers has been called into question. Well, now the South African author and Nobel laureate, J.M. Coetzee, has offered up a book that plays with the idea of memoir. He has written a novel called Summertime about himself. Actually, the novel is about a young biographer researching a book about the late writer John Coetzee. It's a little confusing, but Alan Chews explains in this review.
The book begins with a lot of smoke and mirrors. The major premise of the plot, the much-lauded South African novelist, has died, and there's a biographer going around interviewing people, mostly alert and sensitive women, about his life before his great literary success. The results of these interviews make up most of this intriguingly designed novel. A learned but restrained fellow, Coetzee, many of the interviewees' old girlfriends, some family members testify. He was also standoffish, with little social sense, but he spoke and wrote good English. Alas, a bad lover, one of them puts it, though his Afrikaner cousin Margot points out in her emotional session his concern for his ailing father shows through, as does his love of the South African outback. Toward the end, the biographer pushes one of his former lovers, a French academic who was his colleague at university, to make an assessment of Coetzee's work. In general, she says, his work lacks ambition. The control of the elements is too tight. Nowhere do you get a feeling of a writer deforming his medium in order to say what has never been said before, which is to me the mark of great writing. Too cool, too neat, too easy, too lacking in passion. Well, not in this new book, with its candor and frank design and intricate passions on display.
The latest novel by J.M. Coetzee is called Summertime. Our reviewer, Alan Chews, teaches writing at George Mason University. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Today, technology and disaster. In Haiti, tech has played a vital role in relief and recovery efforts. Moments after the quake struck, eyewitness accounts and photos of the devastation spread quickly on Facebook and Twitter. Just today, President Obama sent his first official tweet from the headquarters of the American Red Cross, where he was touring its disaster operations center. We've also seen phone carriers make it easy to text donations. And Google created a Haiti missing persons widget, which allows anyone in the world to search a database of missing people in Haiti. Omar Gayaga joins us now to talk more about this. He is the technology culture reporter for the Austin American Statesman. Welcome back, Omar.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
And let's start with Google's missing persons widget. How does that work?
Well, a widget is a tool that can be embedded on other websites, so you can just take the code and put it on any website where people can get to it directly. And it's at haiticrisis.appspot.com. And what it's doing is it's aggregating all of the missing persons databases. So, for instance, the International Committee of the Red Cross has one. What Google did was set up this widget to scrape all of the missing persons databases, so you can type in a name or register the name of a missing person and find all of that information in one place.
And do we know if indeed many families have found information about their relatives using this?
I haven't heard much about that yet, but it's definitely the place to start.
How has technology made fundraising for Haiti any different than for other natural disasters that came before this?
Well, you know, a little over a year ago, we talked about the way nonprofits are utilizing technology to make donations easier and also to help donors keep track of where that money is going. And this is really the first major natural disaster since then where we've seen that go into action. And I think the best example is certainly the texting campaign. As of this morning, $13 million has been raised of people texting the number 90999 and texting the word Haiti to that number. I believe in 2009, $4 million had been raised for all charities, for all causes. So already, just in a few days, we've already seen a huge outpouring of $10 donations through that campaign.
Well, comparing what you've seen happen in response to the Haiti earthquake and, say, the tsunami in 2004. In terms of the tech community's response, how would you describe the difference?
5-6 years ago, in 2004, with the tsunamis, we didn't have social media, for instance. We didn't have Twitter and Facebook for people to kind of spread the word and mobilize their friends and get people involved. We weren't getting as immediate video and Twitter accounts and people kind of documenting what was happening. So we weren't seeing as much of the devastation as quickly as we are with this incident. And within the tech community, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of tech companies donating, but also techies coming together to find solutions to make donations easier or to find other ways to help. There was a what's called a crisis camp set up over the weekend on Saturday in multiple cities in D.C., in Silicon Valley, London, and Colorado. And this was just geeks getting together to try to find ways to do mapping or to help speed up the databases to try to make things even easier. So it's been rare that I've seen such an outpouring of help from geeks, even in the video game world. In the game Halo 3, if you set your game avatar to a heart, the company that makes the video game will donate to Haiti relief. So even in these quarters where you wouldn't expect people to be involved or to donate or to care, we're seeing definitely an outpouring of support.
Thank you, Omar.
Thanks for having me, Robert. And of course, we're going to be linking to all of these news events and to resources where you can find more information about this on the All Tech Considered blog at npr.org/alltech.
It's Omar Gayaga, the technology culture reporter for the Austin American Statesman and also for All Tech Considered. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. This is from Abraham Flexner's description of a kind of American school that he reported on 100 years ago. The schools, he wrote, were essentially private ventures, money-making in spirit and object. Income was simply divided among the lecturers. No applicant for instruction who could pay his fees or sign his note was turned down. Secretarial school or barber college or anyone can learn to draw art school? None of the above. Flexner was describing medical education in the United States and Canada. The report that he issued for the Carnegie Foundation, published in 1910, led to the reform of medical schools. And in this centennial year of the Flexner Report, we've invited Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, to talk about it. He's written extensively about the history of American medicine. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
First, who is Abraham Flexner?
Abraham Flexner, curiously enough, was not a doctor. His brother, Simon Flexner, was a very distinguished physician. He was, however, an expert in education. He played an important role in the reform not only of medical education, but much more broadly of scientific research.
How did the Flexner Report of 1910 change American medical education? What did he find, and how did people react to it?
Well, during the 19th century, Americans were distrustful of expertise. There were, through the mid-19th century, no effective medical licensing laws, no regulation of medical practice or medical education. And so the whole field was thrown open to all kinds of practitioners of various medical sects and various kinds of entrepreneurs who set up schools as money-making ventures, just as Flexner said in the passage you quoted.
There were some medical schools affiliated with universities, but then there were these proprietary schools all over the country.
Yes. Medical schools at universities had themselves gone through a major transformation in the late 19th century with the introduction of laboratory sciences and other more advanced fields. But many other schools had not undergone that transformation. They were still back in the old-fashioned mode.
I was looking at Flexner's autobiography, which he published in 1940, and he was recalling some of the incidents of his study trip. And one of them, he says, "I recall that when in Salem, Washington, I asked the dean of the medical school whether the school possessed a physiological laboratory. He replied, 'Surely I have it upstairs. I'll bring it to you.' And he went up and brought down a small sphygmograph, an instrument designed to register the movement of the pulse," he said, or to test blood pressure, I guess. That was passing for a medical school early in the last century.
Yes, because, again, there had been no regulations, so many schools had no laboratories whatsoever. Things were changing already at the time that Flexner did his report. And sometimes people attribute the entire change that medicine underwent to Flexner, but that's not true. Licensing laws were being strengthened. People were aware that changes needed to take place, and Flexner helped to consolidate a movement that was already underway.
Some of the reforms that Flexner proposed they seem like no-brainers today, but medical school should be for college graduates, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Or there should be some kind of experience with dissection, actual looking at a body while you're in medical school.
Yes. All of those things made a great deal of sense. But at the same time, what they meant is that there would be new financial obstacles because medical education would become more expensive. It would become more exclusive. And that was, on the whole, a necessary change. Unfortunately, it did result in a decline in the supply of doctors. And that had very long-term unfortunate consequences for America.
So we're witnessing sometime early in the 20th century a change from a well-intentioned, good-natured local physician who didn't have much training, frankly, to a kind of a trained scientist with a real medical degree.
That was the vision. That was Flexner's idea that science had to be brought to the bedside. And his report played a very positive role in doing that.
Was the Carnegie Foundation so influential that a report from an educator who had sent around the country to look at medical schools could have that much influence on the way the country trained doctors?
And I think what you have to bear in mind is that at that time, in 1910, American society was undergoing a revolution in many different respects as a result of science. The airplane had just been invented. The automobile was coming into use. The telephone was coming into use. People were seeing everyday life transformed by science and technology. They began to have more faith in science than they had before. And the old distrust of professionals as monopolists that ran through the 19th century began to dissipate. And instead, people began to place their trust in science. I think that's why Flexner had so much influence.
Paul Starr, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.